So this is called Back to Basics. Fundamental principles of spiritual life. At one point this was a slogan in the American school system where they realized that children were not being taught very well the very fundamental principles of reading, writing, and arithmetic. So they were going to try to strengthen their grasp of the basic tools they need for their education. So I thought of, it's always good for us to go over the really fundamental principles of spiritual life. I say fundamental because of spiritual life, because these don't just apply to our own tradition. I think you can see across the board in many different religious and spiritual traditions there are certain fundamental laws or fundamental principles of spiritual life. After all, Srila Prabhupada talked about a science of self-realization. So science means that there is a systematic method of investigation of spiritual truth, a method that right now is not recognized by material scientists, but nevertheless it's a science, because and by science, Prabhupada is translating the Sanskrit word vijnana. Many times you see this combination of words, jnana, vijnana. So jnana means book knowledge, information that's contained in the Vedas. This is called jnana. But then then the word vijnana is there, the Sanskrit prefix vi, is a sort of all-purpose intensifier. You take karma, then there's vikarma, really bad karma. It just makes things more. So vijnana is experienced knowledge or ascertained knowledge. And so Prabhupada used the word science because it is based on, it's realized through direct experience. Krishna consciousness is supposed to give direct experience, pareshanubhava, direct experience of the Supreme. So this makes it a science. Material science investigates things that are imperceptible to ordinary people. In fact, imperceptible to anybody. They're only known by certain gross effects that we can perceive. But people are able to discipline people who learn how to work in the science, they're able to understand and confirm what's been experienced. One person does an experiment and other people repeat it, and then they agree, yeah, all the experts, they all find the same thing, so now we regard it as ascertained truth. It's not just a theory, but it's fact. So in the spiritual realm, the same thing applies. And ultimately, we should aspire to come to the recognition of science of God, the science of self-realization. This science will not be limited to any particular religious tradition. right now, there are different ways of pursuing spiritual life. People come to different conclusions. There seems like their findings are incompatible. But I just think this is due to an immature development of the science. I want to talk about general principles that are almost universally accepted. And they're also a crucial part of our own Krishna consciousness. The way they are expressed and the way they're applied will differ. And for that part, the expression, the application, I'll stick to our own tradition. So, and we should also understand for ourselves what are really some of the basic and fundamental principles that we need to keep in mind. We should not get so wrapped up in the activities of Krishna consciousness that we forget these. So the first, the beginning of spiritual life, as Prabhupada puts it, is asking the question, why am I suffering? Now, spiritual life begins with this question. Prabhupada remarks, asking about the ultimate cause of our suffering is called Brahma Jignasa, inquiry into the Absolute Truth. So notice he says, ultimate cause of our suffering. Many people do not deal with the ultimate cause. For good reasons. For example, there was in the United States some years ago a survey taken. Asked people what they were afraid of the most. And at that time, the number one thing on the list was, the highest fear was unemployment. And the people who took the survey found it worth noting that death was down, way down on the list, about number 15 of things they were afraid of. So this is an example of not making the ultimate cause of the suffering. Because you ask somebody, why are you afraid of unemployment? Well, if I'm unemployed, then I will not have any income. Well, what's the problem if you don't have an income? Well, then I won't be able to eat. Well, what's the problem with not being able to eat? Well, then I will die. So you see, it's actually the death problem. But as long as you think it's the unemployment problem, you can deal with it. You think maybe there's a solution. I get the right political party in office, and then we can solve the problems of life. But if you inquire ultimately to what are the problems, then you begin to understand the nature of our situation. But people do not know this. And that's why it's listed in the items of knowledge in Bhagavad Gita text, chapter 13, text number 9. There's a list of the items of knowledge. And one of them is Janma, Mrityu, Jara, Vyadhi, Dukkha, Doshana, Darshanam. Knowledge of the evils of birth, death, old age, and disease. So I want to talk a little bit why this has to be listed. Because it's not obvious to many people. It's not obvious. This point that I'm discussing here is also the first of what Buddhists call the Four Noble Truths. They put it this way, life is suffering. And they use the same word, dukkha. Dukkha. Huh? So, as in this text, janma mrityu jiva vyadhi dukkha. They say life is suffering. We would put it differently. We would say material existence is suffering. The Buddhists proceed by a definition that material life is life. It's not anything that's like another life that you can describe in that word. That's their procedure. So some people do not know this. In fact, most of the world doesn't know this. It is an extraordinary fact, and that's why it's the first principle. I want to read you Prabhupada's purport to Bhagavad Gita 13.9, this point, janma mrityu jara vyadhi dukkha doshana darshanam. Prabhupada writes this: one should try to understand the distress of accepting birth, death, old age, and disease. There are descriptions in various Vedic literatures of birth. In the Srimad Bhagavatam, the world of the unborn, the child's stay in the womb of the mother, its suffering, and so on, are all very graphically described. It should be thoroughly understood that birth is distressful, because we forget how much distress we have suffered within the womb of the mother, we do not make any solution to the repetition of birth and death. Similarly, at the time of death, there are all kinds of sufferings, and they are also mentioned in the authoritative scriptures. These should be discussed. And as far as disease and old age are concerned, everyone gets practical experience. No one wants to be diseased, no one wants to become old, but there is no avoiding these. Unless we have a pessimistic view of this material world, considering the distresses of birth, death, old age, and disease, there is no impetus for our making advancement in spiritual life. So this is Prabhupada's statement. Now, a few years ago, I happened to be reading this purport in an ISKCON temple in New York. I guess it was a Sunday feast. And initiated ISKCON devotee, a lady in the audience, raised her hand, and she protested against this purport. She thought that this was mentally unhealthy. I could understand. She was reacting. I think she was one of these people, like many of us, who had sometimes an early training in the Hare Krishna movement of being so extraordinarily negative about the material world. That people found it somewhat crippling. But Prabhupada uses this word pessimistic. A pessimistic view of this material world. Because what is the future here? It's not good. If these are the real problems, and you want to be happy in this world, solve these problems. Solve the death problem. And in a way, of course, people always have this fantasy that it will happen. I once talked to a young lady, a college student, who really was quite convinced that she was not going to die. She thought that when it became an issue for her, the problem will be solved. She just couldn't conceive that she felt that she was somehow so special and so unique, so wonderful, that this thing couldn't possibly happen to her. There's a psychiatric term for this point of view. It's called narcissism. And young people tend to have this a lot of times. Once you get past 30, you start to realize, you know, material nature starts to chip away at you. But that's why one of the reasons they need young people for fighting wars. Young people feel like this. When soldiers go into battle, they feel sorry for the men around them who are going to get hurt, but they somehow themselves feel they're so special they'll be immune. Once this feeling goes away, it becomes very difficult to keep people in combat without them becoming psychological casualties, if not physical casualties. This is called narcissism. I am somehow so special and so wonderful that it's going to be different from me. Material nature is just going to comply to all my demands. When I go to give lectures in colleges and young people, I talk about this point. Human life is meant for self-realization. And why is that? Because one has to understand, first of all, that the search for happiness will not be satisfied in the material world. We take it for granted that everyone is searching for happiness. We do not, at that point, disagree at all with the materialists. When Prabhupada was asked in the early days of the movement, some lady said, "Swamiji, what is the meaning of life?" And Prabhupada said, "The meaning of life is to enjoy." And I think the devotees were a little, what? Startled. But it is the meaning of life. And our quarrel with the materialists is not with that search for happiness or that meaning of life to enjoy. It's that this effort will fail in the material world. Because one reason is, these are the problems: birth, death, old age, and disease. Now people keep trying to solve them by advancement of technology. I know this is going on all the time. For the last 50 years, I have heard promises made. When I was a child, people were saying that we have conquered infectious diseases, and now the next is cancer, and we will have what they call a war on cancer, and that will be over, and so on. And I believe this very much. But of course, it didn't work out that way. First of all, infectious diseases have come back. Now there's multiple drug-resistant tuberculosis. And now there's new things on the block. Material nature seems to be able to produce new diseases out of her infinite resources. We have AIDS, we have Ebola coming out, and so many things are there. And if in the 19th century people were dying of smallpox and diphtheria and typhoid and typhus and tuberculosis, in the 20th century, we had the honor of dying of heart attack, high blood pressure, and other sorts of degenerative diseases. And it turns out to be, I read a book when I was in college called The Mirage of Health by Rene Dubois, a physician with the World Health Organization, that made the case that just that, it's a mirage. One disease will be replaced by another set of diseases. And there are social factors that really determine what are the diseases you get, but disease itself, it will not go away. And then there's the factor, they say in the United States, 40% of all diseases are iatrogenetic. Iatros is the Greek word for physician. It means diseases caused by doctors. And this is so true. That's why the standard medical people are all distressed, because people are going to what they call alternative healing modalities. Because even if you get cured from a disease, then the next big problem is getting cured from the cure. So one should just simply understand that these things are built into material nature, birth, old age, disease, and death. And if you want to be happy, we say to people, first of all, solve the death problem. Prabhupada described this factor, our position in material nature, as an incompatible situation. From our point of view, we are eternal spirit souls, and as Prabhupada said once, death is an illusion we've imposed upon ourselves due to our desire to enjoy in the world. So we are eternal, we're in a world where everything is temporary, and this is an incompatible situation. We do want eternal happiness. Friedrich Nietzsche wrote a poem which had the line, "Alle Lust will Ewigkeit," all joy seeks eternity. Why? Why is that? It's because we are eternity. We are eternal, and we want our happiness or our joy to go on, not only to go on without limiting, but to go on increasing without limit. That's what we are looking for. And it's true, you can prove it to anybody, that you bring your senses into contact with the objects, you feel some pleasure, you take delight in that, but sooner or later the pleasure comes to an end. The contact between the senses and the object is not stable in the material world. They have this distressing tendency to break off. And so when your happiness or your pleasure came to an end, how did you feel? Well, I felt really bad. I felt horrible. I felt terrible. I felt depressed. I felt aggrieved, bereaved. Why did you feel bad like that? Well, because I wanted it to keep on going. And then we ask, and how long did you want it to keep on going for? Well, how long can I have? Forever? I think it's manifest. The desire we want is for eternal happiness. And we're looking for that in a place where everything is temporary. And as they say in logic, QED. That's the proof. That we will not become happy in this material world. We are led to believe that happiness comes from the sense experience, the pleasure one feels when senses are in contact with the object. But in fact, as Krishna says, you get just the opposite. You get just the opposite. So here we are, we're in this world where everyone is dying around us. If you look at the material world, as Prabhupada says, without any of the filters that we need to be happy, you will see it actually quite a terrible place. It's rightly called Marcha Loka. It's the place of death. We wake up every day. It looks a beautiful day here in Marcha Loka. The sun is shining, and we don't inquire what is going on around us. Just in one little town, how many people right now are dying? Any place in the world, within a 20-mile radius, how many people are in the process of leaving their bodies and suffering? And how many people are in the process of grieving for them? If you could just feel that yourself for one day, you would be horrified. And it's going on around us. We don't notice. It's a beautiful day. We don't notice. Because when we notice, it becomes very, very difficult to go on eating your halva, your khichdi. We don't notice. We have a defense mechanism to keep us in ignorance. There's a saying by Pascal, the French philosopher. He says, human beings are so necessarily mad that not to be mad, mad meaning insane, that not to be mad is another form of madness. So we have our necessary madness, our necessary illusions to say that this world is a nice place. We've invested our happiness in it, and now we cannot look and see what it is like. But you can, in 5 minutes of thought, you can see this. People have noticed this. Thomas Gray in Englishport wrote a poem about watching some school children play at Eton College. And he thinks of what their future will bring to them in life. And he says, thought would destroy their paradise. When ignorance is bliss, it is folly to be wise. Prabhupada quoted those lines also. When ignorance is bliss, it is folly to be wise. But the line before it is, thought would destroy their paradise. This is the way it is in the material world. They cannot look. Prabhupada talks about this in the Bhagavatam. Bhagavatam talks about this, actually. Here's Bhagavatam 2.1.4. He says, persons devoid of atma-tattva, Brahma-gignasa, same thing, do not inquire into the problems of life. Janma, mrityu, jara, vyadi. Being too attached to the fallible soldiers. Notice this word is soldiers. Fallible soldiers like the body, children, and wife. Why are my body, my children, my wife or husband, why are they soldiers? What's the war? The text goes on, although sufficiently experienced, they still do not see their inevitable destruction. The Sanskrit is pashyan api na pashyati. Although they have seen, they do not see. So Prabhupada says, this material world is called the world of death. Every living being beginning from Brahma, whose duration of life is some thousands of millions of years, down to the germs who live for a few seconds only, is struggling for existence. Therefore, this life is a sort of fight with material nature. If you're struggling for existence, you've basically declared war on material nature, which imposes death upon all. In the human form of life, a living being is competent enough to come to an understanding of this great struggle for existence, that we can see that it is an illusory struggle. But being too attached to the family members, society, country, and so on, he wants to win over the invincible material nature by the aid of bodily strength, children, wife, relatives, and so on. So we have basically declared war on material nature. We will lose. We will lose. That's why our soldiers... Because how will I defend myself? Well, I have this. My body is strong. I have medical insurance. I have all these people who were strong. I have a wife. I have relatives. I have children. Yeah, my little replicas of myself running around. You know, even though I'm getting old, look at my children. They're just like me now. They're young. You know. People think like this, huh? Although he is sufficiently experienced in the matter by dint of past experience and previous examples of his deceased predecessor, he does not see that the so-called fighting soldiers, like the children, relatives, society members, and countrymen, are all fallible in this great struggle. One should examine the fact that his father or his father's father has already died, and that he himself is therefore also sure to die. And similarly, his children, who are the would-be fathers of their children, will also die in due course. 100% death rate, huh? This is sometimes called a Holocaust, huh? No one will survive in the struggle with material nature. The history of human society definitely proves it, yet foolish people still suggest that in the future they will be able to live perpetually with the help of material scientists. So anyway, he goes on. It's worth reading the whole thing. So we should not think that we are safe. Here's another understanding, by the way, since Prabhupada mentions the struggle for existence. If you can see that every living organism has this at least one desire to stay alive. Huh? They say the instinct of self-preservation, it's called. Huh? Everyone has that. And when it comes down to crises, people will practically do anything to stay alive. We always have these reports of sailors marooned or people crashed in the Andes who committed cannibalism just to stay alive. You know? Because this instinct of self-preservation is so strong. Now that's the most fundamental desire of life, is just to go on living. So who has succeeded? Where's the success? Right? Everyone has failed. It's 100% failure. So in these ways, Prabhupada has given us this particular meditation on this Bhagavatam verse, how the materialistic people are crazy. Prabhupada says here, the word is talking about this verse, pramatta, that's the word used in the verse. Pramatta means crazy, mad. By the way, one of the qualities of a devotee, the 26 qualities of a devotee, is apramatta, not crazy. Pramatto nidanam, distraction. Nidanam pashyan. Pashyan means that although he is seeing every day, every moment, just like Maharaj Yudhisthira was questioned by Yamaraj, what is the most wonderful thing in this world, can you say? Most of you know this story. Yamaraj, in the form of a yaksha, asked him some riddles. Huh? What is the most wonderful thing in this world, can you say? Maharaj Yudhisthira immediately replied, what is that? Ahani, ahani, bhutani, gachchaniha, yamalyam. Every moment, every second, every day, every night, there are so many hundreds of thousands of living entities. They are going to the temple of death or dying. Ahani ahani bhutani gacchantiha yamalayam shesha stavaram ichchanti. But one who is living, he is thinking, I will not die, I will live for good. This is in the Mahabharata. That is the most wonderful thing in this world. Nobody is taking experience. Prabhupada says that I will have to meet death, and what is next after death? What was I before my birth? Why am I here? Why am I struggling so hard? I want to be happy. I want to be peaceful. Why is there no peace? Have you ever noticed? Have you seen anybody that's for war? Have you seen any single politician or leader that's saying, I'm for war? Universally, they are for peace. And universally, they have degrees, they're well-trained, they're brilliant, they're talented, they're skillful. And they're all for peace. It should be a cinch. They should get peace, huh? With all that talent and ability and effort and will. And still it doesn't come. Huh? Why is there no peace? Why is there no happiness? Why these things? These questions are called Atma Tattva. These are called Brahma Jignasa. So one should ask this. One is not enlightened to ask, what am I? Where am I coming from? Why am I getting old? Why am I getting diseased? So many whys there are. This is called Brahma Jignasa, but they are pramatta. They are mad. After the struggle for existence, although they know nothing will exist, it has come just like a flash and it will end like a flash. There is no, then what is the actual platform of my life, my living condition? They do not inquire. That was Prabhupada's remarks on this. So unfortunately, we can, although we have been informed of this, and although, at least in my case, reflections like these were very instrumental to my becoming a devotee, and for many of it's the same thing. Still, material nature casts her spell and we forget. We kind of forget and we start to scheme, well, maybe I can be happy in the material world in this way, or maybe I can be happy in this way. And this pessimistic view of life, you know, maybe that's not so healthy. We should actually relax a little bit and be comfortable. We should avoid this temptation. We should avoid this temptation. Because not to recognize the world as it is pramatta. It is insanity. Now it is true that if we see the world as it is and we have our investment in it, then we will go crazy. As long as we're thinking our future depends upon the course of material nature, and we see the way material nature actually is, then we suffer from mental disease. It's true. They say that mental disease is increasing. It's the biggest problem, according to World Health Organization. And at least in America, huge numbers of people are they suffer from depression, specifically. I would say that the reason they are depressed is because things are, in fact, depressing. It's actually the only sane response. But because their investment is in material nature, because they don't know of any alternative, then it becomes a mental disease. And, well, we will either paint them a rosy picture, and we have ways of giving them rosy pictures. There's the Hollywood movie ending, you know. The boy meets the girl. There's some misunderstanding or difficulty. Boy and girl are separated. Then boy and girl get back together again, and then you see them walking off into the sunset. The music comes up, it says, the end, they live happily ever after. Keep the cameras rolling, please. Keep them rolling. Let's go on, keep it going. So we have these different ways of fostering ignorance. They're ignorance industries to keep us from thought. The whole consumer society depends upon the idea that we will become happy by enjoying in this material world. So they don't want the consumers to be disillusioned. People will lose money. So we are all there. It's not just Maya herself, but Maya's very organized agents to keep people from thinking. And if you think too hard, well, now we have our pills to give you. Serotonin reuptake inhibitors and everything to change your brain chemistry, so you'll get a little numb and you won't care what's happening so much. Yeah, there's intoxication has always been there and things like that. That's if you have your investment in the material world. How do you become? It's just like if you ever meet people, soldiers who have spent a long time in combat. They suffer what's called post-traumatic stress disorder, a mental illness. And what happens is when soldiers are in combat for prolonged periods of time, everybody around them is dying. And they have to face it and live with it. And what they tend to think is, this is the real face of the world. This is what the world is really like. This is material nature showing her true face. So that when peace comes, they never trust it. They think that at any minute this nice, peaceful situation can suddenly erupt and again it will happen. And of course, they're right. Even in peacetime, if you look at how many people are dying, maybe there's no combat, but basically this death rate is going on. Warfare is just ordinary life speeded up a little bit and made ordinary. So, therefore, we will always be anxiety in the material world. We see, but we don't see. So that means that on a certain level, we know what's going on, but we have to spend a lot of psychic energy repressing our knowledge and avoiding these things. And so we are not relaxed and happy. Even when we have what we want, so this we should understand then that this material life is suffering, and here it is our investment in it, putting our hopes in the material world, that is the actual cause of our being entangled in this material world. So this is the first point, the first point of spiritual life, that I should understand these things. And I think every spiritual tradition, they tell us these things. They say to us, do not invest in this material world. Do not lay up your treasures on earth, where moths and rust corrupt. Don't invest in temporary things. So any questions about this particular point? Well, we all agree about this, I assume. When things are dovetailed to Krishna consciousness, that means I'm not invested. That's the meaning of dovetailed in Krishna Khan, because I depend upon Krishna for the result. And as far as the result goes, however it comes out, that is not my business, that is Krishna's business. I'm simply engaged in Krishna's service, I'm gauging everything in Krishna's service. So in this way, one can engage in action in the world without becoming entangled. And my happiness does not depend upon what happens in this material world. The happiness comes from the relationship with Krishna. And that's already there. So ultimately, we should not be in any anxiety. Maybe our only anxiety should be to become more Krishna conscious. Otherwise, there's no reason for any worry for us. There's an interesting book, if you want some little references for other reading, material guys who have, Sigmund Freud has written a book called Civilizations and Its Discontents, and the first number of pages he gives a pretty wonderful description of why happiness is impossible in the material world. That's pretty good. And then there's a writer named Ernest Becker, B-E-C-K-E-R, Ernest Becker, who wrote a book called The Denial of Death. Came out in America and published, I think, in 74. And it goes into quite detail about how whole human civilization is really a kind of structure or artifice to keep us from dealing with janma, mrityu, jara, vyadi. And he's actually popularizing the work of a person named Otto Rank, R-A-N-K, who was a disciple of original student of Sigmund Freud and developed his own ideas about this denial of death. If you like to read literature, Tolstoy, the Russian writer, has a book, a short, long short story called The Death of Ivan Illich. A very interesting story about how a Russian bureaucrat comes to realize that he's dying, and absolutely nobody in his family will acknowledge it or deal with it. It used to be, by the way, in the Middle Ages and earlier, actually, people used to cultivate an awareness of death. It was a common practice in Europe. People had things they called memento mori, things to remind them of death. There's the famous English poet John Donne, who was also a clergyman. And when he became the head of St. Paul's in London, his official portrait was made, because he was now such a big deal, so they had a big official picture of it. He used to keep his winding cloth around it. In those days, the custom was that when you were buried, you were wrapped in a cloth. It was called a winding cloth around you. You weren't just in a coat and tie or something, but this winding cloth. So his winding cloth, he used to keep it around his picture, his official portrait, so that every time he looked at it, he would be reminded not to get enamored with position in this material world. Huh? So people very commonly, you see illustrations of saints, and sometimes there's always a human skull on their table, so that they look at this, that this is me in a few years. Huh? This is a common thing. So, it's already 10:30. We started it. Okay, I'll start a little bit. So, if therefore we understand why we are that we are suffering in this world, and that material life is suffering, why are we suffering? The diagnosis, what is the cause of this suffering? The diagnosis of this, also, this is universal, and it's also the second noble truth of Buddha. He says the cause of suffering is desire, craving, attachment. Right? He says this is the cause. And you'll see that everywhere, spiritual traditions, when people become serious about spiritual advancement, this idea of somehow becoming becoming free from desire or eliminating desire, becoming detached from the world, this is always there. Asceticism, some form of asceticism is there. The cause of suffering is desire. Why? Why is this? We should understand that also. Again, this is a science. And of course, we don't say desire. Again, we have a different perspective than Buddha. We say material desire. For the Buddhists, all desire is material desire. That's all the kind of desire they experience, and the idea of a spiritual desire that is not available to them. So we would say material desire, because that makes a difference of how you treat the problem. This is a text we can look at. Yehi samsparshaja bhoga dukkha yonaya evate. Here's that word dukkha again. This is Bhagavatam, I think it's 522. Not Bhagavatam, Bhagavad Gita 522. Yehi samsparsaja bhoga dukkha yonaya evate adyantavanta kauteya na teshu ramate buddha. In fact, the word Buddha is used in here. Buddha means those who are wise, in this case, the wise. Huh? But the first statement, we can divide it up this way. Krishna says, those pleasures, bhoga. We know the word bhoga. Here it means those enjoyments or pleasures. What kind? Samsparsa ja bhoga. So ja means that are born from samsparsha. Samsparsha means the contact or the touching between the senses and their objects. So that's the general procedure for pleasure, right? You bring the appropriate senses into contact with the objects of the senses, and there's a feeling of pleasure. And that's, we start to think of, this is where happiness comes from. I enjoy that feeling of pleasure, and I want to perpetuate it and repeat it. But Krishna says, Yehi samsparsa ja bhoga dukkha yonaya evate. They are, in fact, the cause of all dukkha, suffering. This is an astonishing statement. And by the way, there's two words here, he and eva, which are emphatic, just words of indeed or stressing the matter, that those pleasures which arise from the contact between the senses and the objects are, in fact, the source of all suffering. This means almost the whole world is wrong. Everybody's wrong. What television commercial will you ever see that tells you that you buy our product, you will suffer? The whole world is moving under this misapprehension that this is the source of happiness. And then Krishna goes on to say, he says, Adi Antavanta. These pleasures, they have Adi and Anta. They have a beginning and an end. They start and they finish. And therefore, those who are Buddha, wise, Nateshu Ramate, they take no delight in them. They take no delight in them. So why is it that these pleasures are, which seem to be the source of happiness, are in fact the source of distress? We have to understand this scientifically, because it's not just stated in our teachings dogmatically, but rather everything is explained for our understanding. After all, I mean, people go around and they say it's bad, it's naughty, don't do it, no illicit sex, no intoxication, no gambling. Well, can we have just a little bit of sex? Can we have just some intoxication? What would that do? Just a little harm, you know. And generally, all over the world there have been traditional religions and moralities that have taught people somehow or other that you should stop or decrease material enjoyment, or regulate it or decrease it or stop it. And so we have received from our past everywhere these negations: don't do this, don't do that. Even as early as the 18th century, people were resenting these teachings. There's a poem by the English William Blake. He describes sitting in a garden, and there's a church there or a temple. And it has inscribed in the marble the words, "Thou shalt not." And he's sitting there, and he's describing what he's seeing. He says, and priests in black gowns were walking their rounds. Priests used to walk around saying the prayers for the day in a little book. So they were walking around. You'd see them, used to see them always doing this at the right times of day. So priests in black gowns were walking their rounds and binding with briars, you know, with the thorns, my joys and desires. So people, somehow or other, it has come down to us from the past, these negations and these restrictions, but people no longer understand the reason for them. They only think there were some nasty old guys, some patriarchs who didn't want people to have fun, who hated life, and somehow out of revenge put forward all these don't do this, don't do that, don't do that. And I've seen people in our Krishna consciousness movement who are also very frustrated with this and have suggested that we need to change our principles. Why can't we change the principles a little bit to make things a little easier? But if one has an understanding of the reasons for these restrictions, what is the problem with sense gratification? Then we can understand. We should understand completely why it is this samsparsha bhoga is in fact the source of all suffering. We should know this very well. Here's what happens. Prabhupada has a purport to this verse. And the very last line of the purport, he says, he states the case, the more one is addicted to material pleasures, the more he is entrapped by material miseries. And a nice sentence. Huh? Some of these sentences are worth memorizing, and you can bring them to your mind. The more one is addicted to material pleasures, the more he's entrapped by material miseries. In our case, our understanding is quite clear. We are provided with a map of reality. The incompatible situation for us is that we are eternal spiritual beings. But now we are embodied in these material structures of the gross and subtle bodies. Not only do we have the material bodies, but we identify with them. And this identification of the self with the material body is what causes the difficulty. As spiritual beings, we want perpetual, ever-increasing happiness. But because we identify the self, we have what we call the ahankara, the wrong idea of ourselves. We identify with the body, and then everything that happens to the body I experience is happening to me. So that's our picture of our situation. So now we have to examine that situation in a little more detail and try to figure out what to do about it. I think we'll take a break now. That was depressing enough. We'll come to the solution of the difficulty. Let's take about 15 minutes, huh?